The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it.
Ladies and gentlemen, lions, tigers, and bears, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your movie autopsy dojo. I'm your host, Silvio Emery.
And I'm your co-host, Annie Meller.
And today we're diving into my area of expertise, animation, with the 2008 movie Kung Fu Panda, directed by Mark Osborne and John Stevenson, starring your favorite and mine, Jack Black. So, context. We want to do something a little bit more fun, because we've been doing kind of dire portents lately. So
yeah.
We need to do a quick one because Annie, you're going to be doing a little bit of traveling in the next couple of weeks. So Need to do a couple episodes in quick fire succession. So something quick, something light, and Kung Fu Panda just kind of fit the bill. You know, it's on Netflix, so it's easily accessible. It's fun. It's a classic that a lot of people have seen, and there's a lot of stuff for us to talk about. So what, Annie, do you have any kind of personal history with this that you want to talk about?
I actually do. I was thinking about that a lot as I was watching it. My experience with watching Kung Fu Panda was not from 2008. It was a little bit later on, I think in 2013 or 2014, when I was in my second year of graduate school. And I was really kind of struggling. And I just sort of found this film uplifting because it's also about somebody who is struggling. And at the time, I wasn't paying a ton of attention to all the themes that were being expressed in it. But I have to say that I did enjoy it on that first watch. So that's kind of my relationship to the movie. It's something I enjoyed. How about you?
I think I saw this in theaters. And this is probably one of the last movies I saw before I went to college. I went to college in September of 2008. So 6th of June. That would have been about that time. So this is probably one of the last, like, cinematic things I shared with my family.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of weird because, like, this is kind of weirdly transposed in my memory because, like, it feels like the kind of movie I had on DVD at home, but, like, I obviously wasn't home for that period. So I've not actually seen this that much, but it kind of sits in a weirdly familiar place like that. Yeah, and, but, like, I really like Jack Black, and, like, I, as an animator, this has been one to look at. In terms of DreamWorks Studios, this is kind of where they get a little bit away from just being the Shrek guys.
Oh, and where so they start looking at. That's what they were known, like, for prior to this.
Well, DreamWorks has a bit of a history, and besides breaking out with Shrek and creating one of the biggest movie franchises of all time, they were kind of the knockoff Disney for a while. And even though some of those films have, you know, some merit on their own and aren't what you might assume to be, for example, you know, A Bug's Life is shit and Ants is, you know, fucking Heart of Darkness, which is great. It just, you know, you don't remember it at the time because it looked different. However, you have your Ants. And you also have Shark Tale. Basically, DreamWorks spent a couple of years being the kind of guys who would, rifle through Pixar's garbage and be like, aha, they're making a fish movie! Fish movies are what the kids like! We'll make a fish movie! We'll get Will Smith! And I think Kung Fu Panda kind of marks, at least, I don't have their film catalog in front of me right now, but this is just from memory, is Kung Fu Panda kind of marks where they start making original movies and breaking away from being, you know, the Kmart Pixar.
Youch. So shady. But yeah.
Hey. Well, that's the thing, is they really struggled to find to fill the 3D space because their 2D animation department was fantastic in, like, the early 2000s. They did, like, early 2000s, late 90s. They did Sinbad. They did Road to El Dorado. They did fucking Prince of Egypt, like, one of my favorite films of all time. And then they went to 3D, and they struggled. They really did struggle. And that whole era of animation is just kind of a big tragedy because there were a lot of really fantastic 2D feature animated films that didn't do well at the box office.
Oh, that's really interesting, too.
So, you know, Disney had Atlantis and Treasure Planet. Fox had Anastasia and Titan A.E.
Okay.
You know, there was a lot going on in that era that just, for multiple reasons, didn't really succeed. And in the transition to 3D, Disney had the leg up because they had Pixar under their belt, and Kung Fu and DreamWorks was not doing so great. They just kind of, I'm not going to say they lucked into things with Shrek, because Shrek is a good movie, but like, it's out there, and it should not, I don't think any reasonable person would have looked at it and said this is going to be as successful as it was.
That makes a ton of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, this got a couple of sequels. It's still, I think, a big franchise. I'm not sure if they're making any more.
Have you seen the sequels? I have not seen any of the sequels.
I have not, but I've heard that they're quite good, and I've heard that they've done very well at the box office. So I don't have too much.
Keep the original cast?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's impressive, too. Because a lot of times what happens with sequels is you lose some of the cast, unless you're Toy Story, so.
Well, I think, here's the thing. I think we've reached kind of a different level of franchising, because when you look at the paradigm of, like, the Disney Classics Collection, for example, animated sequels used to be a low-budget throwaway production. You know, Aladdin 2, Lion King 2, you know.
Mulan 2.
Mulan 2, exactly. Because, first of all, Disney used to do a lot of fairy tale adaptations, and there isn't a sequel because most of the original fairy tales end with someone fucking dying. So they have to write a more poorly researched thing, and they try to capture the market, so they do it in, like, the couple of years after something comes out, and so it's produced more quickly, the animation isn't as good, it's released on home video, which means it doesn't make as much of an impact. There's a lot of factors that make those suck. Kung Fu Panda and its sequels, Shrek and its sequels, these are released theatrically. They are bigger productions than their predecessors. They have a bigger budget because now that they're a sequel, they're a known quantity and they're expected to make more money. And that's just the new reality of animated sequels from these big studios, because the direct-to-video market has kind of disappeared, really. I mean, that's not to say that there isn't a place for low-budget animation or, you know, those kind of cheap, hackneyed films, but, like, the economics of that and the distribution has changed. That's where you get a lot of, like, you know, junk that gets thrown up on Netflix or Hulu, but, like, it's very possible to just go through life never seeing them. Whereas I think, like, in the 90s or otherwise, like, it was like, oh, hey, you know, you go to Blockbuster, there's Aladdin 2, you know, there's Hunchback of Notre Dame, Electric Boogaloo, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still remember that.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And, like, yeah.
That's not how that story ends, buddy. That's not how that story ends. No, 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 no. So let's review this, actually. Annie, if you want to go ahead and start.
Yeah, sure. I still really enjoy this film. I think that there are some problems with the narrative, which we can address while we chat today. But overall, I think this is a... Like, the environment that they set up in this film is really aesthetically beautiful, which I deeply enjoy. I think that Poe as a character is kind of adorable at times, although there's some fat shaming of him that goes on quite a bit. And there's some confusing narratives about how you become the Dragon Warrior, which we'll talk about. For me, this is going to be a B+ or an A-, I think. It's really sitting in that range. Like I said, I enjoyed it. I think there's issues with the narrative, but the overall production is pretty great.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and give this one a solid A-. I think in my memory, it was an A, not necessarily an A+.
It wasn't mine,
and
too.
And there are certainly moments in this where it becomes an A+, but it doesn't hold that throughout. And I think some of the things that it does, and, like, I was willing to forgive. I know that it's a movie about, you know, Jack Black. Jack Black is integral to the role of Poe.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, you know, you expect some tubby jokes or whatever, and it's coming from an actor who has a lot of control over his image and the things that he says. He's not being forced to do it. So there's, I was expecting that, and I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. He's a panda. He's fat. We'll make a little bit of fun of it. But when you got to the, you know, whole, like, oh, yeah, carrot and stick to make him do kung fu
yeah.
good. That kind of pushed it over to, like, okay, this is an actual theme, and we're going to have to actually address this. That aside, it is a really beautiful film. One of my favorite villains. And just aesthetically, one thing I really like is this is a DreamWorks film that really kind of set, like, it's difficult to describe this because we're in an audio format, but this is a aesthetically unique film in that the character design very much veers away from what you'd call classical animation. There's going to be animators out there who are just going to rake me over the fucking coals for trying to make up my own terminology about this stuff. But it's like shape-based design where, like, these typical, like, cartoon construction, either you go for realistic construction or you go for, like, that Pixar-style construction where everything is kind of built out of basic shapes. But when you look at Tigress, for example, she's not built out of shapes. She's built out of lines.
Huh. Okay, that's really interesting.
Like, she's curves and straight lines that form these limbs, but you can't actually just, like, say, like, okay, her head is a sphere. No, her head is, like, this weird kind of, like, oval with a flat plane for a front, you know? It's very difficult to describe, but it is very specific. So, like, it is a 3D design space that feels illustrated. And, like, that's complicated to describe, but I'm kind of confident in how that describes it. So, like, and just...
I think that's accurate.
Yeah, no, it holds up really well. And I kind of wish there weren't the images, but also, for 10 years old, like, it's not... It does have its problems, but it's not, like, overwhelmingly negative. It's not, like, fully embracing that shit.
It's not as bad as it could have been.
I mean, faint praise, but come on. Like, there's a reason that this is getting knocked down to an A-, but still, like, it is lovely. Okay, so let's get mechanical for a minute, and let's talk about kind of what works about this film. And I think the core of this movie is Jack Black, and yeah. He does a wonderful job in this.
He's so good.
You and I both love Jack Black. Absolutely. Oh, we were actually debating between doing this movie or School of Rock. And I don't know what the shooting script for this movie was like. And I don't know how much of this was Jack Black improv or Jack Black, you know, have himself writing and having writers work for him. Because, you know, some bigger names in Hollywood do that. They have writers who will specifically consult and rewrite scripts that they're in to make them sound more like themselves. I know Will Smith has one.
Uh-huh.
But regardless, his influence on this film really makes this character very likable. Because I'll actually say that I think Poe is a difficult balance to strike because, what his character arc kind of is self-depreciation into self-actualization. And it's very easy to take that kind of self-depreciation and turn that into what is initially an unlikable or a whiny character.
Right. Yeah. A character who manifests self-loathing, which the audience, like, might not necessarily get behind. Yeah. No, instead he comes off as very humble and not just self-deprecating, but it seems like he's a bit put upon, but in a way that we can empathize with. Not feeling like you should take on the mantle of your family that's a very real feeling, a feeling that you're different and you want to do something different. I think that's something that a lot of people can empathize with.
Look, Annie, let me put it to you this way. Everyone in my family is either an MD, an engineer, owned a fashion house, or a PhD. So I'm an animator who does a podcast and plays video games on the internet.
And everyone in my family is a scientist, except for me. So, yeah. So, I think that's who this is appealing to. We are all Poe. That's that's the philosophy here, really.
Yeah. And, like, as all, also on the whole, there is a fantastic voice cast in this. Just going down the list, it's, like, it's a smorgasbord of talent. You've got Jack Black. Dustin Hoffman just is absolutely wonderful as Shifu. I love it.
Yeah, he is.
And I would honestly complain about, you know, oh, this cast is so white. And that is a valid complaint.
Yep.
But also, they did a good job. And, like, I don't want to take that away from them before we get into it. And I think that's something that's maybe more of a deep cut.
Yeah, we can come back to that.
But it is worth noting.
Uh-huh.
I'm also going to just jump ahead of the gun here. And because I love talking about villains, Ian McShane is incredible as Tai Lung.
He is fantastic in this role. I immediately recognized his voice when I heard it again, because I don't think I even thought about the voice acting when I first saw this. And he's just a riveting presence in this movie, vocally.
Yeah. It's also really funny because it lets Ian McShane do something that I don't think he can get away with as a screen actor. Because Ian McShane shouting about his daddy does not work when he looks like Ian McShane.
Yeah. No.
You know? But he's so compelling. And he has, like, I hate to use the phrase animal magnetism, but yes.
And joke crimes.
Oh, yeah. Joke jail with me. Mm-hmm. Any performances that were particular standouts for you?
A standout to me was James Hong as Poe's dad, Mr. Ping. I think he just gives this really sweet performance as Poe's dad and as somebody who's trying to connect with their son and not really fully understanding what's going through his kid's head. I think he does a great job in this. The other person that I would give props to would be Lucy Liu in this. You know, I feel like she's a bit underutilized in this movie, but what's there is pretty adorable and fun, and I really liked that.
Yeah. I actually really like Angelina Jolie as Tigress, because there are some themes here that I picked up on that I have never picked up upon before in this movie. Particularly the direct parallel between Tigress and Tai Lung as proteges of Shifu. Really emphasize that whole, you know, narrative of work twice as hard to get half the recognition.
Yup.
And yes, there's a tragic circumstance that somewhat justifies it in the eyes of Shifu, blah, 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 but also, like, Shifu is explicitly a failure and explicitly made mistakes. And it's seen as a naive thing that he treated Tai Lung with that kind of, you know,
kid
I guess,
gloves.
I guess kid gloves, that kind of faith. But Angelina Jolie, one thing that she is really fantastic at doing is, like, barely restrained contempt and anger.
Yeah.
She is so good at that. Watch this. Watch Maleficent. Like, that is something that she is...
Oh, Maleficent's so good.
Or, you know, watch Beowulf. She is so good at that.
Yeah.
She is so fucking good at that. I will say, I think David Cross and Seth Rogen are kind of... accessory?
Yeah. Like, I kind of feel
I actually,
like, shrug.
Like, David
bit.
Cross is okay. He's playing David Cross, and that's whatever. I actually like Seth Rogen in this, because it's great having the contrast of, like, you know, his deep bear voice coming out of the tiny this mantis. That's kind of fun. But there's not much to it. But weirdly enough, why the hell is Jackie Chan in this? Not saying that he shouldn't be, but they didn't use him at all. I think Monkey has maybe three lines with words in them. He's got a lot of, like, lines and nothing of any real consequence. And he's a, you know, kung fu movie staple. And, he, like, racist thing to say, but this is definitely a consideration for filmmaking. If you want to have a Chinese accent in there, you have no better excuse than to have Jackie Chan in your movie.
Well, because he's such a recognizable vocal presence, especially for audiences in the United States and Canada, I think it would have been wiser for them to expand his role a bit more. he's critically underutilized in this movie, and I'm really unsure as to why. Like, I understand that there needed to be five characters to, you know, fit this group that Poe kind of idolizes, but at the same time, the Furious Five kind of feels like it's got two people in it that talk, and then there's three other people who don't say very much, so...
Yeah, I mean, you've got Tigress, who is the rival to both of the Dragon Warriors. Yeah. You've got, you know, Viper, who's kind of the more supportive one. And then you've got Mantis, who makes acupuncture jokes. Monkey, who doesn't do anything. And Crane, who's just like, hey, remember Arrested Development?
Yep. Yep.
No, but, like, on the whole, though, I also want to just give, like, just a quick shout-out to Michael Clark Duncan as Commander Vachier.
Because
he is so deep and rumbly, and he has that boisterous, you know, good old boys, dare I say, thin blue line energy that is really fun and sinister and machismic to the point of detriment. Like, it fits perfectly. But I think, though... Randall Duke Kim as Oogway is wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. He pulls off that balance of kooky Zen wisdom, but also possibly ambiguously senile so well. And he's genuinely a fun character. And, like, part of this is the writing, but a lot of this is the performance, is... when he takes, like, this whole, like, meditative approach, but also breaks it down into these really simple reductive metaphors, it's like, you know, yeah, you can't make a peach tree an orange tree, dumbass. It's really fun. And, like, especially in a movie for children, to be able to introduce these concepts in, like, controllable, understandable chunks is important. But also, it's done in a way that, for me as an adult audience, is still fun.
Yeah, it is. The other thing I really liked about Randall Duke Kim's performance is his delivery of the line, I don't know. I thought that was really great in particular. It's just this great moment. Like, this is someone who can speak in these really philosophical platitudes, but at the same time, he can just kind of also shrug and say, like, meh, not really sure. And the way that he delivers that line is delightful.
I think one of my favorite lines from him is, you know, there is no such thing as bad news. Tai Long has escaped. That is bad news. It's so good. So yeah, we've kind of talked about the voice acting a little bit, and I think the pacing is really fun too. Like, there's a lot of physical comedy, and like the physical comedy is part of the story a lot, which I really appreciate. Because I think there have been a lot of movies I've seen over the years where physical comedy is seen like something as a part of a checklist. So, you know, you'll have movie and then you'll stop the plot for 5 minutes to have a wacky sequence. And then you'll go back to the plot. Something like weirdly enough, I think Mouse Hunt might be an example of that, where a lot of the gags don't move things forwards, even though they are why you're there. So, like, this was delightful, particularly the, like, the dueling chopstick sequence, the whole dumpling fight, was incredibly well animated, very funny to watch. And like I say, it falls in that problematic area of, hey, fatty, come get your cookie. Yeah, you're good at kung fu now. There are problems with that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that that scene is wonderfully choreographed, has a brilliant soundtrack, and is fun and kinetic in a way that you really don't see that often.
Absolutely.
Actually, here's a question for you, Annie. How would you rate this as a kung fu movie? I know you're maybe not the biggest aficionado of kung fu movies, but I know you've seen a few.
I mean, I wouldn't exactly compare this, and I'm going to broaden this out to martial arts. I am not a martial arts specialist. I did boxing and fencing, so I don't know the differences between certain fighting styles within that, but as a martial arts film, I think there's kind of a... there's multiple dimensions to martial arts films where you're teaching people the skill behind martial arts. And I feel like that's what's going on in this movie. Like, this movie is about self-actualization, and that is part of that process. So in that extent, I think it's good. In terms of the choreography, I'm not really that sure that it can rival quite a few movies. The animation is fun, but I mean, it's no Ip Man by any means, or Enter the Dragon at all. So, yeah.
See, that's interesting, because I kind of hold it to a very different standard, because, like,
okay,
I do think of it as very separately from live-action martial arts films, because live-action martial arts, they are a spectacle in kind of their own unique way, as you are looking at this kind of beautiful dance of choreography and staging, right? So, you know, you have a lot of classics, particularly, you know, like, anything with Jackie Chan in it is just the way he did takes and so on. Like, even his American productions, like, at least some of the early ones, like Rush Hour and so on, have these amazing stunts and so on. But when you're working on animation, that's not as impressive, because you have full control over all the bodies in the room. So it's less of a physical feat. So I find this to be an impressive martial arts film, first of all, in that I feel like it kind of captures that spirit of, you know, seeking destiny, and, you know, the training montage, and this kind of existence in, like, a kind of almost supernatural world where martial arts transcends normal physics.
Time and space, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of transcendental in that way, but also, like, the way that the characters move is very inventive and very snappy and kinetic. And I could talk a little bit more about, like, you know, the timing and the spacing they do, but it snaps. Like, the impacts feel impactful, and martial arts are themselves integral to the plot. For example, when Po says, "I figured it out," like, it's a lovely kung fu movie moment. You know, it's the hidden technique. It's about the scroll. It's about the legacy. It's about being the chosen one from a school of martial arts.
And it's about finding that within yourself as well. It's not usually an outside thing. It's a thing that comes from within, so.
Yeah, so I don't think, well, I'll agree with you that, you know, if I want to look at the strict definition of what a martial arts movie is, there is no possible way that this is even in that category. But I feel like it is, first of all, a love letter to the martial arts genre.
Yeah, but it definitely
also,
is.
Also, it captures some of that spirit.
Yeah. Okay, that's actually really good to know in terms of, like, your perspective as an animator. This is stuff that, I don't know, I guess it's about the poetics of the action, you might say.
Yeah, and there's also an old folklore, actually, I don't know if folklore is quite the right word here, and this is a Japanese folklore, I believe it might have been Musashi I'm thinking of, where there's a famous story where he's sitting in his room eating rice, and there are flies in the room with him, and he kills 7 of the flies with his chopsticks. And the assassins that had been sent to kill him that night retreated because, first of all, he had killed 7, and there were 7 of them, so he knew their number, and he had demonstrated his skill with the chopsticks, so clearly he was showing off that he was not afraid of them.
Yeah.
And so there's a parallel with that and the mastery they have over the chopsticks in the dumpling fight.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Martial arts as kind of a metaphor of self-actualization, of complete control.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a solid thing, and maybe I'm reaching a little bit to make a direct comparison there, but I feel like it's in the spirit. I don't think it's necessarily an allusion to that specific story, but this whole idea of playing with chopsticks or playing with mundane objects as a show of martial prowess is something that I think is part of that kind of storytelling tradition.
Well, I think chopsticks are also part of the Karate Kid franchise, which more people might be familiar with. And you're right, they have become this kind of index of a whole bunch of things like control and self-actualization and all that in martial arts films made in the West, definitely. If we want to even use the term the West.
Yeah. And I know this is difficult to discuss in an audio format, but beyond the characters, the setting is absolutely gorgeous. The vision of China they have with, you know, the reds in particular. The color palettes are beautiful. The peach blossoms floating everywhere. And there are a lot of, and this is one thing I think is really cool is, weirdly, I think a movie that might have a little bit of aesthetic in common with this that I don't think a lot of people will make the comparison to, and this might just be my personal childhood VHS collection speaking through, is Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes! Yes! Okay, all right. I'm glad that you said that, because I was also thinking about that.
Because one of the things is, a lot of things that this does are very, like, reduced. And I don't mean that to say that they are lesser, but simplified and, you know, purified. You know, distilled concepts that are present in other movies, that but are restricted by the realities of what is achievable. In particular, like, if you watch, here in Thailand, like, Wushu TV is really popular. You know, not so much in the West, and that's its own cinematic tradition. But a lot of those films are distinctly unrealistic. You know, like, you see them, and, you know, it's all high-flying wires, and particularly, well, like, balletic. You'll get a lot of stuff with, like, yeah. But what you have here, so there's a disconnect then between the reality of actors on screen and the CGI or the wire flying that is required to make them move like that. So there is kind of a sense of separation of the worlds where, like, you know, if you're going to have, like, a dragon rising out of a pool, you're going to know it's CGI. You're going to know that it is a separate world from the actors. But here you can do something like the petals gently dropping the scroll and the single touch and the ripple that clears the pond. You can do those, and they are perfectly congruent with the characters, and they are part of the same world. And there's like dozens of little moments like that. The way they play with the blossoms, you know, Oogway disappearing into the ether. The way they do the martial arts strikes, particularly the paralyzing strikes that, you know, show energy ripples through people. A lot of that stuff that they do is stuff that's kind of old hat for Kung Fu, but also feels natural and organic in this world in a way that it doesn't in a live action production.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the sound design is also really good. The chimes when they do those touch strikes are wonderful.
They are. The other space that I really, really enjoyed was the Jade Room, where Poe first kind of experiences what it's potentially going to be like to be trained by Shifu. It's just this gorgeous room, and I really love this scene so much because it's something that's very deeply familiar to me. Like I said, I saw this, you know, kind of my second year of grad school, and Poe walks into this room, and it's this gorgeous shade of, like, jade and emerald to it. It's just fantastic. He walks in there, he's totally flabbergasted by all the objects around him, and he's talking about, like, he can name each one and say where it's from and all that stuff. And man, that just kind of, like, hit me in the heart, because as a art historian, when I walk into certain spaces, I kind of turn into Poe in that scene. And so the setting was beautiful, and the scene itself was just really familiar and heartening to me.
Yeah. And I think that's also kind of a key appeal of the movie, is this idea of, you know, geekery and fandom, is this idea that it's okay to be enthusiastic about things that maybe you're not necessarily a complete part of. And, you know, fandom is kind of a complicated thing to discuss in its own right.
It is.
But the simple fact is that we appreciate and we identify with media we consume. And up until this point in his life, now, granted, Poe is the ascendant fanboy. He is the one who has chosen to ascend and join his heroes.
The special boy. Yeah.
The most special boy. But beyond that, though, he has enthusiasm and he has love and he has appreciation for these things. So when he comes in and he can just recite these things, he's not saying, like, is this your test? This is the 1,000-year jar? Of course I know the 1,000-year jar. He's just, oh my God, this is the 1,000-year jar.
Yeah.
It's over 1,000 words. So it's like, these are things that engage him. And Jack Black delivers the energy of that so well. Like, you know, you know people who have talked about, like, Star Wars shit like that. I know people who have talked about Lord of the Rings like that.
Funny you should mention Star Wars. The director actually wrote that scene as a kind of mirroring of his experiences of going to George Lucas's ranch. So it's directly inspired by that. Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, it's a very modern impulse, I think. Because, like, we have a connection to media that I don't think we've necessarily had historically as a society. And it's a complicated field that we're still learning to navigate, and we're seeing kind of the life cycles of franchises and fandoms as kind of separate, but things, what happens when a fandom is resurrected by a thing, what happens when a fandom is displaced. There's a lot to go into, and there's plenty of, you know, amateur scholars on the internet doing sometimes well-researched, sometimes not so well-researched stuff on it. And it's a fascinating topic in and of itself. I remember just the other day, I saw this huge video because I was doing some freelance work, and I put on some videos in the background, and one just came up on a playlist about, like, the history of the Homestuck fandom. And, like, there's a big connection. Apparently a lot of Hetalia fans moved into them, and there's some reasons why they were considered obnoxious and all that. And, like, there's such a history to it, but, you know, granted, there were sci-fi conventions, like, from the 60s even, but I don't think that we've been as intimately connected with these franchises, at least not in, like, this kind of mass population way, until, like, you know, the 2000s.
Well, and not just intimately connected, right? I would say directly connected, and I noticed that you cite the 2000s. Social media has definitely changed the way that we relate to objects and relate to different fandoms and different fan cultures, I guess you could say, because people have the ability to make direct comments. They have the ability to speak to creators and tell them why they liked something, or in the case of Rian Johnson, why they hated something. So, you know, social media has opened up a lot more of these platforms for people to talk about things, for these cultures to shift and change and sometimes form other movements. It's really a kind of fascinating moment for that. And I guess this movie's sort of on the cusp of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the soundtrack. Like, I don't have much to add about the soundtrack, but it is lovely. The instrumentation, the arrangement. There are some genuinely, like, heartbreaking moments. There are some genuinely frightening moments. It's just wonderful and grand, I think, is maybe the word to use.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's a grand soundtrack.
Yeah. So let's move on to kind of some deep cuts here, because we've got a lot to talk about. First things I want to say is, I do want to clarify, because we are going to be talking about cultural appropriation in this episode. There's no way to get around it, because this is a film made by an American studio for an American company, hiring mostly white actors to portray characters of Chinese descent and cultural context for a primarily American audience, even though China responded very well to this. It did well at the box office. Critical reception was generally good, and they say it was respectful. We do need to discuss what the concept of cultural appropriation means, and what, because it's such a loaded term these days. And what happens, I think, is this is what happens with a lot of kind of progressive or, you know, social justice language, is people will say, hey, you know, that's kind of racist, and they'll say, like, you know, racism exists on a spectrum from, you know, lynchings to, you know, stepping across the street or wanting to touch black people's hair. Those are all forms of racism, and people conflate, you know, a natural curiosity about hair. Like, I've heard so many stories about people saying things that they're mortified about as adults, as children, to, you know, people of other races because they don't understand. And it's, like, natural, good-hearted curiosity. And they're saying, that can't be racist because I'm not a bad person, because racism is lynchings, you know? So when we say cultural appropriation, it is a neutral term. And Annie, do you want to just go ahead and kind of tell us what that means?
Yeah, so as an art historian, people appropriate images and objects and modes of storytelling all the time throughout the history of human culture. In fact, it's the way that human culture is made. So, for instance, if you drink tea, if you do yoga, you are participating in cultural appropriation. Now, these are forms that we deem acceptable, But these are things that were taken from other spaces. With tea specifically, this was taken from China and also India. And forcefully, this was part and parcel with acts of genocide. So those
tea
are things...
Tea killed a lot of people, guys.
Tea killed a ton of people. And it's important to keep those things in mind. But it's also important for people to understand that appropriation is part of how humans make culture. Now, that being said, there are certain acts of appropriation that we deem to be very harmful. So, for instance, the debate surrounding dreadlocks is really important. Because a lot of times what you find is that people are conflating different forms of hair culture with one another when dreadlocks in the Rastafarian religion are an essential part of that faith. The other thing that I've noticed with debates around cultural appropriation is that a lot of times people will say cultural appropriation when what they really should be saying is racist caricature. And that's a very important thing, especially when it comes to Halloween costumes. Wearing a sombrero and riding a donkey, like what you see in some of those costumes that you can get from Party City, that is not cultural appropriation. That is the donning of a racist caricature, which is very, very reductive, as are costumes for like in the image of Native Americans. And we've also seen some blackface costumes this Halloween. Those are explicitly forms of racist caricature. So it's important not to conflate the two things. What we have in this movie is definitely a form of appropriation that's going on because it is a kung fu movie, and kung fu movies and martial arts films in the United States and the UK are appropriative, but sometimes also appreciative. It just depends on the context. Was there anything that you wanted to talk about in particular with regards to appropriation?
With that specifically, I did just want to mention the idea that when we say cultural appropriation, it is not always with a negative connotation.
Right.
With regards, because one of the things I've found is when you bring up the phrase cultural appropriation, that seems to trigger in a lot of people this kind of reflexive, defensive stance. It's like, oh, you're some kind of hysterical leftist SJW cuck scold who doesn't want people to have fun.
Right.
And I want to kind of demystify the term a little bit because there are different variations. One example I can think of is actually one of the contexts to consider is who is benefiting, historically dominant culture taking from a subjugated culture, or is this, for example, a great example is kimonos, when tourists are wearing or kimonos in Japan and so on. These are often being sold or rented from Japanese people and who are in a willing exchange of culture that is very different to a drunken girl at a frat party wearing a Native American headdress, which has very specific cultural connotations and was definitely not made by or given or in any way condoned by Native leaders who would be part of the tradition of that headdress. So when in this particular case, I'd actually say that the overall context of this film is slightly troubling because, again, this is DreamWorks. Now, for the later films, I know, for example, Kung Fu Panda 3 was co-produced with Chinese investors and a Chinese company. But this first film is still, white people taking Chinese culture and doing it very well, but still doing it for primarily white consumption and to the benefit of them. So this is appropriative, but it is probably the most genteel version of the bad version of appropriation that we can get.
Well, I think the key thing to remember here is that this movie doesn't seem to be blind appropriation. Blind appropriation is where you run into problems because that is taking things out of their context completely. There's no study there. There's no attempt to understand what's going on. So this movie is not a blind appropriation. This is a very, knowing appropriation, which can in some ways even be very troubling in itself, right? Obviously. Especially considering what we know about the authors of this movie and the fact that they're don't seem to be collaborations with Chinese creatives in the making of this film. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, actually, was that you had mentioned that Chinese audiences liked this film. Could you elaborate about that a little bit more?
Okay, so this is difficult for me to really quantify because, first of all, I am not Chinese and I do not speak or read Chinese. However, there's a lot of measures I have found. Like, I've tried to do like a bit of cursory research, but I didn't have a lot of time for this because, like I said, you're traveling. We're doing multiple episodes in a week, so it's difficult. But these movies smash the box office in China, first of all. So from a casual audience reception point, audiences, by as objective of a measure as you want to consider box office to be, are at least receptive to the film. Secondly, I have read that there have been multiple Chinese animators, for example, animators in animation studios, who have said that they do a very good job of, you know, respecting kind of Chinese cultures and so on, and portraying it well on screen. There have been imitators. There's one with a rabbit. I forget the title. And no, from Chinese studios is what I'm saying. I cannot directly view, and I don't have any resources that will look directly at Chinese critical reception, but I've seen no indicators that they've had a problem with it. And multiple indicators even that they enjoyed it, appreciated it, not necessarily endorsed it, but it's such a difficult thing to find, and, like, I would need to find and speak with multiple people, you know, from China who are aware of critical film discourse and so on. And that's kind of a tall ask for us. But from my limited knowledge and research,
yeah,
not speaking that China is a monolith and their film culture is this or that, it seems that generally speaking, Chinese people have appreciate and have not found this film to be offensive.
Oh, okay. That's a
little
thing.
So there we go. A lot of disclaimers for that statement, but
no, I think that's important to acknowledge. Like, we have projects like Coco now where you have Latinx creatives working on the project because it's a story that's located within, you know, this very specific culture of storytelling. And, you know, like, that's been a really cool thing to see companies doing, is pushing away from, I guess we'll call this a Eurocentric model, where you have, like, a mostly white cast and mostly white crew who are working on a film that deals with another culture. So it's interesting to me to see that there is new stuff going on, but that there was also an appreciation for this film, Kung Fu Panda, originally as well.
Yeah, I mean, Kung Fu Panda 3, I believe, broke the animated box office record in China.
Oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. Again, I haven't seen these sequels, so I'm interested now.
Yeah. Yeah, also, fun fact, because it was co-produced with a Chinese company, it did not count towards the quota of American movies that were allowed to show, so it was allowed to show for longer, and it wasn't, like, subject to a lot of the same restrictions.
Oh, that's interesting, too.
So, yeah, it's, I mean, that's the thing. Call it cynical if you want, but if, you know, the Chinese companies are jumping into bed to also profit off it, that's perhaps a cynical form of acceptance, but it is a form of acceptance.
Yeah, well, it's placing their imprimatur onto this as a project, which is great, by collaborating, so. Oh, I was going to ask if we could talk about some of the body politics in this movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And what this movie has to say about the path towards self-actualization and how that happens.
Okay, I think those are two separate topics, so let's talk about bodies first. Because, like, this movie gets by so much on charisma.
Mm-hmm.
It's got wonderful it has wonderful performances by some very talented actors and some very likable actors. Jack Black, in particular, sells this movie. Without Jack Black, I think this movie is garbage. Straight up.
Totally.
Like, first of all, Jack Black has a career making fun of himself as a tubby dude. That's just a thing. And I think without the implicit consent of Jack Black to do that, a lot of the jokes would not work. I mean, they probably would have worked back in 2008, but they would not hold up as well for me or you today. And, you know, we're fairly progressive. We're fairly body positive and inclusive.
And, yeah, I think it would have come off as mockery instead of, well, some of it still comes off that way, obviously, but instead of being like self-reflexive humor, which is more of what Jack Black does.
Yeah. And I was okay with that up to a point, but what I forgot was that, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, is this idea of, you know, he's really talented when he's thinking with his stomach. Is, you know, fatty wants food is the trope they're kind of going for there. And yeah. That I found to be uncomfortable. I don't want to use the phrase offensive because I'm not, you know, a larger person myself and I don't want to speak on other people's behalf. Yeah. But, like, knowing people who are, you know, plus size, knowing people who have had struggles with their weight and so on, I'm not comfortable with using that as a laughing stock.
Yeah, well, and I think also it's not just a laughingstock, right? Like, he explicitly states that when he's upset, he eats. So he's an emotional eater, and the film presents this as his weakness. And so the film then, throughout those scenes with the carrot-stick dynamic that it creates, also creates this narrative of turning a weakness into a strength. And I'm just really not sure what I think of that. Like, again, I would love to hear some critique of this from people who identify as curvy or fat or plus size, just to see what their opinions are on it, because it seems to be mocking in some ways, and then in other ways it seems to be, like, trying to present a character who is larger on screen.
Yeah, the other thing I want to say also is, first of all, his fat is kind of his weapon, but secondly, he is kind of, it weirdly feels like kind of conversion therapy at the end, because he, at the end of the dumpling fight, he chooses to forgo the food. He chooses to just throw it away. He doesn't need it anymore.
Yeah. Which,
like, I think it's supposed to be this idea that he has escaped his habit of stress eating.
Yeah.
Which, on paper, sounds kind of positive, but we haven't necessarily delineated that from him being a large character in general. So it just seems like by becoming disciplined, by becoming actualized, he has removed the need for himself to fill him, gorge on food and become fat. And, like, he's a panda, so the metaphor doesn't work, but, like, I think, like, if these were human characters, the implication would be that from that point, he would train and become skinny.
Yeah, which we know that he still maintains the same shape throughout the other sequels, like, on the posters. So, yeah,
So it's this kind of weird mix. It's anytime, there's a reason that metaphors are metaphors and that they are not literal comparisons, because metaphors break down. The more you look at a metaphor, like, occasionally, very occasionally, you get the perfect metaphor. But metaphors generally diverge from reality at some point. And this happens pretty quickly. And, like, animal society metaphors do run some risk of racism, do run some risk of, like, some very unfortunate kinds of stereotyping or, you know, biological essentialism.
Right. Yeah.
Because, like, it's hard. Like, we talked about this in Bright, is you can't say that, you know, everyone's the same, and also say, but by the way, these people can fly and these people
can't. But they
are
different species. Like, guys, no. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. Yeah, no, and I understand that. I do.
Anyways, please read my 600-page thesis on why these people are all the same species and can all reproduce together and can also all be biological children. I'm not crazy, guys. I'm not crazy. It all makes sense. Yeah, no, it's, this is why something I'm very wary about, and this is something they struggled with, for example, in Zootopia.
I was just going to bring that
whole,
up, yeah.
Yeah, the whole prey-predator dynamic was something that they really struggled with, and they rewrote that movie several times because, like, the kind of problems that they ran into. And, like, it's a difficult bridge to cross, and, like, I think they've conducted themselves well in this film and in Zootopia, but it's something to be wary of.
And with regard, so was there anything else you wanted to add on kind of the body front?
I mean, the one thing that I did actually appreciate about this movie is that it's focused on a character who is not, like, wiry, thin, and super, super muscular, which is what kung fu movies tend to focus on. But other than that, I think we've talked about the body in a way that's, like, a little bit more critical of the film, which is good. Okay. So.
I have a few more things to add then real fast before we move on. Okay. One, I like that Poe fights with his body. And one thing that he avoids that I'm very happy about is a trope I've seen in a couple of, you know, these, I think both Japanese and Chinese martial arts movies, I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the fat brawler, because they are typically drunks, at least from what I can recall, is you have these large, boisterous, joyous men who drink and have their belly showing, and they throw their weight around, and they are powerful, but they are not, I think, aspirational for a lot of people, is they are this kind of other. But Poe is our main character. He is a character through which we experience growth and through which we explore this world. And he fights by throwing his weight around. He's reactive and fun. And in the final fight, I think without the baggage of the training montage and some of the earlier stuff, I would even argue that the final fight is, you know, body positive, because it is part of who he is. He's comfortable. He's flowy. And he moves, dare I say, like water. One thing I noticed actually in the final fight with Tai Lung is Tai Lung is actually damaged more by the environment than he is by Poe's hand. In particular, when they're rolling down the stairs, for example, Tai Lung is the only one who hits the ground. Everything kind of rolls off Poe because, you know, he's soft and blubbery. Whereas Tai Lung is all lean muscle and so on, so, like, these impacts hurt him.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to say is, one thing I really liked about this, especially I think in contrast with Zootopia, which I think is kind of a weird comparison to make since the movies are so far removed in time, but I think is apt because these are probably the two biggest animal people movies. But like, look at Tigress, for example. She's not sexy in the classic Hollywood sense. You know, she's not an hourglass figure with, you know, a 33 waistline and a giant ass. She's not even like, you know, your skinny waifish one. Like, look at her arms, actually. It's a fascinating idea, is her arms have these big curves on her forearms that create this kind of crescent shape. So, like, I'm not going to argue that she isn't sexy, because the internet will disagree with me very hard, and it's going to get weird. But she does not fulfill the typical archetype of what a sexy, powerful woman is. She's not, you know, the classic She-Ra. She's an illustration. And Viper, I think, also achieves some of that because, you know, she's got the eye makeup. She's got these kind of classical female signifiers. And especially Lucy Liu does a sexy voice. Let's just be honest. Between you and me, she does. But
all the time. That's her normal voice.
Absolutely. No. And, you know, she's nurturing, caring.
Yeah.
But also, she's a snake. She's not a body that we are designed to lust after. And she does have these kind of feminine curves and this, like, she
plays with feminine curves. Well, she has curves because she's a snake. Like,
exactly.
Snakes are but, all curves.
Like, you know, she's a deadly viper, dare I say. But, little Quentin Tarantino joke for our audience. Mm-hmm. But she's, like, I think by not having a body that we project our kind of own socio-sexual hang-ups on, they're free to be a bit more fun, you know? They're free to be characters first and sex objects. Hopefully never, but it's the internet. Let's get real.
Yeah, it'll happen. It'll happen anyway.
Yeah, there we go. So I think that's my last comment on bodies.
Okay.
What was the last thing we wanted to talk about?
Need to talk about the narrative trajectory for Poe and this kind of, like, dare I say, man, we're sort of like the one-hit wonders with using the word ubermensch, but...
You're stealing my bit, Annie!
But yeah, so you had some thoughts.
Okay, first of all, I'd actually say this is a case where it is not a case of Randy and Ubermensch.
Yeah.
So,
which I think is that's very important to mention, because this is such a common theme in a lot of action movies, is that's the narrative trajectory the protagonist character gets.
So first things first, I want to mention kind of my own history and my own kind of hangups with the idea of destiny. Is it's a complicated topic to bring up in any kind of story or media, because destiny says a lot. Because destiny does not exist in a objective sense, because, and I'm not talking about like in real life or anything, that is your own philosophy, that is not for me to decide for you, but objectively the destiny in a story does not exist outside of that story. It is something that is written, and thus it is something that is not divorced from the authorial intent. So when you say that a character has a destiny, you are invoking a specific trope, and you are also making some kind of declarative statements about the nature of the universe. So when you say that there is a character that is destined to be something, whether they achieve that something or not, you have already placed expectations upon the audience about who that character is and how they exist in the world, because it becomes a question of, do you fulfill or reject your destiny? And so part of that is, like, there's a lot of permutations of this, and there's a lot to discuss. You know, there's, you know, Terminator 2, no destiny but what we make it, no fate but what we make it. There's, you know, Harry Potter's chosen one. There's a lot of permutations in that. But in this particular one, Poe is the chosen one, and what kind of, I think, helps him accept and helps him achieve that status is the faith of others that he can be the chosen one. Because initially they all logically reject it because, you know, he's fat, he doesn't know how to fight, he's not one of us who has been training our whole lives for it, there are more worthy people, the force that he faces is insurmountable. They have very good reasons to not believe that he is. But I think that the reason that they come around on him, and also that he turns around on himself, is the faith displayed in him by others, particularly Oogway. Once Oogway departs, Shifu shows faith in him, and once the Furious Five are defeated and come back, they, I don't think, necessarily have faith with him in him until after they see what he has achieved. So it's this kind of chain effect of, I think, if I had to kind of, I guess, try to pick apart the metaphor, it's that nurturing possibilities yields realities. Because I think if Shifu had maintained his original trajectory of trying to drive Poe out, Poe would be gone. And it is his acceptance of faith based on, you know, Oogway's words is, you know, his, it's not his faith in Poe necessarily, it's his faith in his master. It's so what I feel happens in this film is the idea that having faith in others and the judgment of others is what allows society, is maybe the wrong word, but these people to function. It allows them to ascend and push each other to new heights.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. And am I talking shit?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense, because one of the notes that I have in my notebook here is that victory is collaborative, not individualistic in this film. And so we do get this sense that, like, I guess in terms of tropes that you find in Disney films and lots of other films, there's this idea that it's coming together as a team that completes the path that's necessary. Like, obviously, Poe's character needs to self-actualize, but you're right to point out to the team dynamic. It's once the team begins to recognize him as one of their number, that's when he really starts gaining more confidence and becoming the what is it, the Dragon Master? Is that it?
The Dragon Warrior.
The Dragon Warrior, yeah. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. And one thing I like is that actually, in a way, like, one of the things I don't like about the kind of Chosen One story is that it marks our hero as being special and being greater than other people. And Poe kind of is in a degree. You know, he takes up the training very quickly. And, like, we don't have hard numbers. This isn't dated like a fucking David Fincher movie or anything. But we get a sense that time passes and the time that Poe has to train is very short. But he still is the greatest martial artist who ever lived. However, one of the things that I kind of like, and this is maybe a bit of a post hoc justification for what they do, but it's a read that I think kind of works for me and helps me be at peace with this film, is that Poe is not the greatest martial artist because he is the most technically skilled martial artist. I think it is because he is most at peace with the philosophy of the martial arts, because he is, first of all, the only one to understand that there is no secret ingredient. He is the one that understands it's about faith, it's about self-actualization, it's about, you know, externalizing your own power and all that. Like, it's about self-reflection. Right.
Well, and his story is also about persistence, right? He's not necessarily the most talented of their number, nor is he the most cunning of their number. Like, in many ways, he's kind of a foil to Tai Lung. But he is the most persistent one. He's the one who screws up, and yes, he's a bit clumsy, but he's also willing to take risks and to experiment and to do things, even if that means sitting on a rocket to try and get himself over the wall to see the five.
Now, I want to seize on a single word you said.
Yeah.
He experiments. Because yeah. That is... not necessarily how he achieves victory, but that is the final blow, is Shifu didn't teach you the wushu grab. No, I figured it out. Because one of the qualities he does have at the beginning of the film is he is an enthusiast and he is a fan of martial arts. So it is something that he thinks about. And so, you know, I figured it out is a trope of certain kinds of martial arts movie is, you know, your tiger claw cannot defeat my iron horse stance, you know, is this kind of... idea of abstracting martial arts into like a chess game almost.
Right.
You know, catch and release, cat and mouse, counter to counterpoint. And that's something that I think kind of works because you see that the move, I think you can make a very direct contrast between the move, the fight between Tai Lung and Tigress, which is super kinetic and absolutely frenetic in its pacing and its timing and its spacing. It's just punch after punch, kick after kick, movement to different phase, you know, above the boards, below the boards, on the ropes, in the air. Like, there are so many different phases to that fight, and it moves so very quickly. But when you compare that fight to the fight that Poe has with Tai Lung, Poe's fight is much more simplistic. It's very much just throwing back whatever he has at him. So I think... Poe, and like I said, this is maybe me doing the legwork for them and giving them the benefit of the doubt, but I feel like Poe kind of earns being the chosen one because he acts correctly, not because he acts the best.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I have to admit, when he first came to train, I was sort of hoping that this was going to be a narrative about somebody who didn't necessarily have natural aptitudes, but who could learn things. I don't know. Do you feel like that was carried out in the plot? Because I think that towards the end of the film, it came more around to like, oh, this has kind of been inside him the whole time. So it's this idea of having an innate talent that just needs to be harnessed in a certain way. How did you think about that?
I think if I really wanted to dive into that, I think the difference between Poe and Tai Lung is security and confidence. Because Poe accepted that he was the Dragon Warrior. Tai Lung needed the scroll to complete him. He needed ultimate power. And that is why he loses. One kind of concept that I think comes up in martial arts movies and a lot of other different kinds of media is this idea of losing at the bluff. There's a famous fight scene in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure
and it's not really a fight scene, but a character has defeated the entire party except for one guy. This character cheats at cards, and they've put themselves in a situation where they are staking their soul. Jojo is staking his soul against the souls of all his friends who have been defeated. Jojo is the name of the character, Jotaro. Whatever, I'm not going to get too into it. And then the gambler sets up the card. They're playing, I think, blackjack or hold'em, whatever. I'm not really sure. It's been a while since I've seen it. But Jotaro plays. He goes all in without looking at his cards. And the gambler knows what cards Jotaro has, and he knows what cards he has. He knows he stacked the deck so that he cannot possibly lose. But because he has a doubt versus Jotaro's absolute conviction, he loses in his heart. And I feel that's something that happened here, where both Poe and Tai Lung saw the scroll, and where Poe has understood it and internalized it, and is even willing to share it, really, when you look at his dialogue with Tai Lung. Tai Lung is convinced that there is a trick, that there is a deception, that something is wrong, and that, you know, that he's been lied to or misled or so on. And so he is reaching and scrambling. So where he has this fearsome prowess, he is blind to where to apply it. Whereas Poe knows that he is the dragon warrior and he must stop Tai Lung. It gets a little bit into predestination and so on, but like simplicity of purpose and clarity of purpose, I think, helps. Because one thing you look at Tai Lung's entire arc is, I think his arc is finished before he reaches the fight with Poe, because his arc is, I did everything to make you proud. Are you proud of me? You were like my father. You know, it is being spurned by his father. His arc is not the Dragon Scroll. His arc is, you know, the weeping child.
Which, by the way, can I just say what a brilliant shot it is whenever Shifu is preparing to attack Tai Lung and he sees the child that first came to him.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
I love those shots so much. So, yeah, I think, like, and this is why I think this is a good kung fu movie. It's not necessarily, like I said, it doesn't fulfill a lot of the classic check marks that you need to have a kung fu movie, but
it's the spirit of the thing. And
I'm wary about saying that it's the spirit of the thing, because, you know, it is appropriative and it is a lot of things, and there are issues with it.
Well, but yeah, what I mean by that is that it's a meditation on what kung fu is.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Yeah.
And it's a ride. And it's a movie that I think is very surprising to a lot of people, because you hear Kung Fu Panda, the name sounds stupid. It's
the name sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Disarming. You're like, it's a movie about a panda that does kung fu starring Jack Black. You don't expect it to be good. You don't expect it to have heart. You expect it to be stupid and maybe kind of funny and memorable. But there is a sincerity to this film that I really enjoy, and I think that's part of why it's a classic, is no one expected it to be this good.
Mm-hmm.
And while it does have problems, I do think it is that good. There's a reason they made 3 sequels. There's a reason that I remember so much of this film so well, and I think that's Kung Fu Panda for us. Do we have anything that we want to say to Mark Osborne or John Stevenson?
I really appreciate the craft behind this movie, and not just in terms of the animation that you've explained, but also in terms of the comedic timing and the balance of comedy with just kind of honest emotion in this film. I think that's also part of what makes it a classic.
So Mark, John, this was lovely. Maybe be a little bit nicer to Jack Black. He's a treasure, okay? Cheers. So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery, animator at large, and Annie.
And I'm your co-host, Annie Neller.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at DoubleDocMD, also on Twitch at the same name. I stream video games and, you know, just talk the shit. It's fun. Annie, where can people find you and your work?
people can find me on Twitter at Lights and Music, where I take pictures of my dog, my food, and I retweet academic articles that I like and think are accessible.
To be perfectly clear, she means lights and music, E-N, not N.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You guys can follow us on Twitter at MovieMorgCast. Otherwise, we have links to our Facebook, our Discord, and a couple other things down in the comments below. Our intro music, as always, is by the wonderful Ipso Factibus. You can find a link to that EP in the show notes below. We are supported by listeners, patrons, and friends. What helps us most is subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, review us on iTunes, listen, and tell your friends about us. Beyond that, if you want to support us financially, we do have a Patreon at patreon.com/doubledocmd. Hopefully we're looking to start doing bonus episodes next year, and those will be exclusive, but will also eventually be available to everyone. That is the plan. We're working on it. Get back to you on that one. But thank you guys so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.